Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest running podcast, now in our 18th year. I'm your host, Jess Marquez, and our guests today are Peter DeRate and Mark Pace, President and Vice President of the International Gaming Standards Association, or IGSA, to talk about the organization's 25th anniversary, woohoo, as well as all the wild adventures that have taken place along the way. This podcast is sponsored by Pavilion Payments, which empowers gaming institutions to create an enhanced patron experience with a complete suite of integrated payment solutions that enable safe, secure, and trusted cash access at the cage, on the casino floor, or online. Learn more at pavilionpayments.com. The gaming industry of today is worlds removed from that of 25 years ago, thanks in large part to innovative figures and organizations such as the International Gaming Standards Association. Two huge catalysts for the creation and development of the IGSA are President Peter DeRate and Vice President Mark Pace, who have worked tirelessly over the last 2.5 decades to standardize the industry we hold so near and dear. The pair spoke with GGB Managing Editor Jess Marquez via Zoom in August. Peter, Mark, thank you guys so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. How are you guys doing?
We're doing very well. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jess. Doing well as well.
Of course, of course. So, for our listeners, you know, the reason why we have our two esteemed guests on this afternoon is to talk about the International Gaming Standards Association, which this year is celebrating its 25th anniversary, which is an impressive milestone for any organization, especially one with such a wide international presence. So first off, I'd just like to say congratulations to both of you and congratulations on your success with the IGSA. It's very impressive.
Thanks, Jess.
Thank you.
So I kind of want to start at the beginning, and as I understand, if my research is correct, an open letter from John Akers in 1996, and a friend of the show, we love Akers, was eventually led to the formation of the organization in 1998, which, just a bit of trivia for you guys, that's actually 1 year after I was born. So just to...
thanks for rubbing it in.
And just to put that in perspective for the listeners, that was a long, long time ago. And I kind of want to go back to that time and kind of could you kind of talk a little bit about what you guys were doing at that time and just kind of how the organization came about and what it was that made you want to get involved?
Absolutely. First of all, as it relates to the letter from John Akers, that was the first meeting that John called together for the industry to start the creation of industry standards. It was October 30, 1996.
Okay.
And following his call for standard, there was a follow-up meeting that took place in December 11, 96, with 32 people from 20 companies participated at. Most of these names I still have in the old folder. And Jeff Friedberg from Silicon Gaming at the time became the elected moderator. So that's a bit of that history. Now, as it relates to where I was, what I was doing, I started in the gaming industry in 1986, developing table solutions, mainly for Holland casinos, but all for around the world, displays for OLED displays and table management, blackjack, big wheel, all these kind of systems. So all focused on the table systems. Now, in 1997, after 11 years, I was asked to come and join Aristocrat in Sydney, which I did. Then I arrived in Sydney at the beginning of 97. Towards the end, in August, I was offered a position in Reno, Nevada to work for them. That was their main office at the time in the United States.
It's so actually my hometown. Sorry to interrupt.
Sorry?
my hometown.
Sorry. Oh, really?
Yep. Anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm disabling some stuff to avoid interruption by Zoom. So in 1997, and in September, when I was working there, started officially, I was made aware that a meeting took place in Las Vegas where the industry comes back together. And I was asked to represent Aristocrat. And that meeting took place, I think it was December 1997. That was the fifth meeting after the initial meeting from John Akers. And I represented Aristocrat. Moving forward, the year after that, in May 1998, the organization, which was then named Gaming Manufacturers Association, was incorporated in California as a 501c6, which is a nonprofit corporation. There were five officers elected at the time. One was Jeff Friedman from Silicon Gaming. He was the chair. Ray Heidel was the president. Rich Schneider became treasurer. Fred Leitchok was vice president, membership development. And myself was secretary and vice president, public relations. It was a very small but passionate group of people. During our annual meeting, which was given, I think, in May 98, shortly after that first meeting, Jeff accepted a new position for Microsoft in Washington State. So he left Silicon Gaming, moved from Microsoft to Washington, and I was elected chair. And I've been chair or involved since then, which is 25 years or more, except for 10 months when I joined another company, but I was asked to come back to manage GSA. So that's my story around the time that the organization was incorporated. Mark?
Yeah, I guess my story goes back a little further. I started in this silly little industry of ours in 1982. I was still in university, and I started working at Harrah's Atlantic City. Harrah's was, I think, all of 2 years old at the time. And I was working in finance and accounting and became truly enamored by slots and started to get more and more involved in slot operations, and then had the opportunity to move into technology. And you know, this was the era when personal computers were first coming out, the era of big iron sort of going away and mid-range computing coming in, System 36s, System 38s from IBM. And it was interesting to see what we could do with a little personal computer that had 16K of memory, one full height 360K floppy drive, running DOS 1.0 and something called Lotus 1-2-3 1.0. And we could create spreadsheets and automate things and do analysis much faster than the IT guys. So sort of I was recruited to go into IT, but I always ended up going into slots. Fast forward, I left the property, moved to Harrah's Corporate in Memphis, got involved in all things related to opening a casino from the ground up, systems and everything else. And then moved again to Vegas when Harrah's moved our corporate headquarters from Memphis to Vegas, and got into regulatory affairs. And that's when my boss at the time, a gentleman who was very much involved with GSA, mm-hmm. a gentleman by the name of Bruce Rowe, suggested that I fly up to Reno to meet some guy named Peter Durrett, because I had been working with regulators and achieving some level of success, and GSA needed somebody to sort of look after regulators, bring them in, and sort of create a committee to harness their ideas. And he thought I would be a good candidate. And I met Peter and became involved with GSA, and I've been involved ever since, now representing first Harrah's, then WMS Gaming, and then Scientific Games before it became Light and Wonder, before finally joining IGSA as a full-time staffer.
Interesting. Okay, so it's funny that little snippet, that little audio bit, you could go in a time capsule almost. You know, it takes everyone back to certainly a different time. And you know, looking at the industry back at that time, what were the problems? Like, what was the things that needed to be solved, or what was the impetus for forming such an organization that you needed to take action?
Well, maybe I'll yeah, start from an operator perspective, yeah. And you can give your perspective, sure. From the association.
Sure.
So being in slots, right, and this was an era where, keep in mind, in 1982, the world was slowly moving from what we lovingly called electromechanical slot machines, which were just one step above the old fully mechanical slot machines. These were slot machines that had some level of electricity in it, not electronics. Mm-hmm. We were moving from electromechanical into the electronic age, with games from a manufacturer called Universal being probably one of the first ones, at least in New Jersey, to have sort of, you know, electronic games. And at this time, also, the initial systems related to player tracking and player loyalty in slot machines were being deployed. And so what was happening as you kind of continue moving forward in time from 82 and into the 90s is that you had a wide variety of communication protocols that were used by the slot machine manufacturers. And so when you were trying to connect these slot machines to a singular system to get accounting information, to get player tracking information, it was incredibly difficult. And at the time also, if you go back in time one more time, and you think that in 1985 was when the SAS protocol was introduced, you realize that wow, things were pretty primitive. I mean, SAS was and still is a point-to-point serial interface, but at least it was something that, because it was developed by IGT and IGT was having significant success in putting slot machines on floors, it became sort of a de facto standard. However, Bally had their own protocol. Other manufacturers had their protocol. So from an operator's perspective, it was very difficult to get slot machines connected to a singular system. I think at one point in time, we had counted somewhere close to 20 different protocols being used.
Wow.
Which, it's absolutely ridiculous. So Gamma was formed really with this idea of, listen, guys, we're talking about plumbing here. I mean, clearly there should be a standard set of plumbing requirements that everybody can adhere to so that we can eliminate these interoperability issues. So that really was the impetus behind Gamma being formed.
Yeah, that very well said, Mark. To add to that, one of the other things element was twofold. Number one, innovation or lack of innovation. If you are an outsider and you have a product, for example, a bonusing solution for gaming, which happened and became very very successful, and you've been awarded a patent, you need access to data from the various machines in order for you to exercise or make the bonus engine work. And if you don't have access, you simply cannot roll that out. So it is a major incentive to ensure that the industry provides more open access to the information that, in this case, if you're a bonusing solution provider, you would need, right? The next thing that we've seen coming out afterwards is what I call market control. Operators who could select the machines, typically they select their CMS, casino management system, first. Once they select that casino management system, the challenge is that he not necessarily might be able to get some of the successful games. An example that I'd like to bring up, which I vividly remember, is when Bellagio opened up, or before it opened up, I talked to the vice president of slot operations, and he was very frustrated. He could not get WMS machines, which were very popular, on his floor. And he himself started digging into why that was. And he shared with me that he took the effort to try to understand that. And the reality was, there is a proprietary protocol language out there that was controlled by the manufacturer and released whenever they wanted to release it, making sure that they had it all implemented on their machines. But if it goes to other vendors, other suppliers of slot machines, they only had access to that 6 months later. And for them to not only implement, but also get the product certified by the regulatory authorities, simply took too long. And therefore, the operator could not get access to these machines at the time of opening. There was always a delay. So that control, that market control, was another reason for making sure that, as Mark said, the plumbing, that there is no secret to the plumbing. In general, there is no secret to the plumbing and should be open access for data.
Well, that's interesting. And given that history and given that that foundation from which that you guys were working off of, I would imagine that the reception was probably a little tough. You probably had to do a little hand wringing when you were starting out. Is that the case?
Oh yeah, it was indeed very challenging.
What were those first 5 years like?
They were painful. They were exciting times, but also painful in the sense that we had to learn fast, very quick. I mean, don't forget, you bring competing entities together of a very small industry, right? Just the mere fact that you have engineers, think about that, in a room talking about technology scared most companies, right? Mm-hmm. So we had to put policies in place. We had to see how to manage meetings, antitrust policies, all the things that you normally don't think about. At least I wasn't never used to, and our industry definitely wasn't used to that. We had to put that into place. So that was a very exciting times. What, however, happened is that some operators who came to the annual meeting, which, as you know, annual meetings are open to everybody. The operator specifically in this case was Greg Solomon from Mandalay Bay, or representing at that time Mandalay Resort Group as an independent company. He was the vice president of slots, and he came to the annual meeting. And immediately after that, he sent us a check for the membership. Oh, well, we are the gaming machine manufacturers association. We are not, we excluded operators. You can imagine not only that, manufacturers and operators together in a room, that's a challenge, right?
Yeah.
we had a private meeting in the foundation room upstairs. I never forget, it was 4 p.m. or something. And Greg set it up because it was a Mandalay property. And in there, we had Mandalay Bay, Harris, Park Place Entertainment at the time, Stations Casino. And we met together and the operators really got excited about the idea of having more open access to information. So they fully endorsed and supported it. And that is what happened. The year after that, the operators joined. The board accepted the fact that operators can be part of the organization. And we renamed ourselves as To Gaming Standard Association. And then after that, we actually very rapidly grew not only the membership. At one point, we had 75 members, but also the number of releases of standards. In 2003, we actually released the very first best of breed. We call it Bob standard. It's today replaced by G2S. We also released the very first peripheral standard for peripherals like bill acceptors, coin hoppers, printers. Yeah, and they use GDS, which is a USB-based open standard that we adopted. So a lot of work was done, not only on the structure, the operations of the corporation itself and the policies, but also from an engineering perspective. Now that the operators were on board and support all that, the suppliers, of course, I mean, it was really a very active and a very nice time.
The one thing I will add that Peter alluded to but didn't get into the details of is he said, imagine when you bring a bunch of different engineers from competing gaming manufacturing companies in a room. They're engineers. They're not political individuals. They're not legal individuals. They're not thinking about IP policies. They're thinking about engineering solutions. And then they would go back to their company and they would report, oh, we were talking about this. And, you know, we're talking about doing, you know, such and such and such. And all of a sudden, the IP attorneys at that company would be freaking out and writing IP submissions like crazy. So one of the things that had to be implemented was a very robust IP policy within these committees to make sure that the ideas being freely bantered around to improve the industry were not, you know, hijacked by a single entity and then held to ransom the industry. And that you know, was a huge undertaking.
We looked at ANSI, the way ANSI works, of course, American National Standards Setting Organization. And we had to tweak it. So I never forget, it took many, many months. And there are now very kind of, an outsider would say, weird policies in place on the IP and requirements for technical committees that every member has to abide by or opt in order for it to comply to, if they do have IP, to license it under what we call RANT terms, reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. And even that could be interpreted, but that's a legal term for that. So Mark is absolutely right. That alone is all part of this starting up phase, which, oh my God.
Growing pains
for sure.
Well, I'm smiling and I truly want to take a second to say thank you, honestly, as somebody who grew up, you know, somebody who is enjoying the fruits of your labor, if you will, as somebody who grew up in Reno and got to experience, you know, the success of the industry, and thanks in large part to organizations such as yourself. And I know that the undertaking, as you just explained, is massive. So again, I want to take a second to sincerely thank you guys. Kind of moving on to over the course of the following 25 years, obviously. I know you guys obviously talked about, you started off in slots and kind of that was the foundation. That was the manufacturer side was kind of the biggest impetus for the formation. What are some of the other like biggest advancements and or, you know, victories and challenges, if you will, that have come up in the last 25 years? What are some of the biggest moments that you can remember?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the first is still significant even after all these years. So if you're familiar with what we lovingly refer to as Class 2 gaming, mm-hmm. right? Games that use a bingo math model. When tribal entities started getting recognized and when tribal entities started running casinos, they started implementing Class 2 systems. And then as ticketing came out, they layered ticketing on top of these Class 2 systems and Class 2 games. The problem at the time with one particular casino, the Seminoles in Florida, was that they had I believe, four different class two systems on their casino floor. Each class two system was, you know, created, developed by a certain manufacturer that also provided the games, and the games talk to the system in order to operate, which is standard for class two centrally determined systems. The problem was this, that if a player cashed out a ticket from slot machine on system A, they could not go to slot machine on system B, insert that ticket into the bill validator, and have it be redeemed.
Wow.
So they had to go wait in line at the cage, redeem the ticket, get money, go to the other slot machine, put it into the BV, and rinse and repeat with every ticket they got.
Wow.
Unless they played a slot machine that was made by the same manufacturer. Now, we in the industry might know whose machine is, you know, which one is which, but most players don't, right? So this was a massive problem for the Seminoles. And they came to us and they said, hey, you know, this is a problem. This is an interoperability issue. This is a, looks like a communication plumbing issue. Is this something that you could help us address, or you in the industry can address? And as a result of that, we developed the industry, GSA at the time facilitating it, created what we call the system-to-system protocol. And that all of a sudden allowed all of these systems to talk to each other, and then allowed the Seminoles to have different systems, but a completely seamless player experience in terms of cashing out tickets. That was huge for them.
Yeah.
I mean, huge to the point where, you know, at the time, Lyle Bell, who was also one of our long-term chair people, was, I think, VP of operations, if I've got that right, down at the Seminoles,
IT.
He basically said the growth of the Seminoles can be pinned to this one victory that we got thanks to GSA creating the standard.
Wow.
They would not have been able to grow to what they are today had it not been for the fact that we solved that problem. So that's a really big win, right?
And a
perfect example of how communication protocols provided significant uplifts to operations. That was one win. The other win was when G2S, the game to system protocol, was developed. Again, continuing its updating and new innovations being introduced, which culminated into remote configuration and download capabilities, which the SaaS protocol does not support. It cannot support. So the ability to download, you know, operating systems and game themes from a server to a slot machine, the ability to download peripheral firmware to printers and bill validators, the ability to remotely configure slot machines, changing denominations or hold percentages, of course, aligned to and complying with whatever regulatory requirements in the jurisdiction were. That was another big victory. And most recently, one of the things I consider a victory and something I was personally involved in is we were asked to participate with the European Commission in a mandate they issued specifically for the creation of a standard online gaming reporting mechanism in aid of regulators providing oversight. It's a lot of words, but essentially what the EC was trying to do was compare apples to apples across their member states as it pertained to online gaming, and they could not. And they could not because there were different definitions, different formulas, different reporting requirements, different reporting frequencies, all of this craziness. And this was the first time really the EC had dipped their toes into the gaming industry. So there was a lot of political ramifications to it, a lot of landmines that you know, people stepped on as they were navigating this. typically, you're given 2 years to create the standard. We lost 6 months, maybe even longer, going through these political issues. But we were able to create a standard. The standard was voted on by all the member states, and it was ratified, and it was, you know, again, a pretty big success because we had a lot of member states that were participating, and it was a really cool thing.
No, I agree, Mark. I mean, there, I have a whole table of what we achieved every year. It's quite significant. I mean, other standards we've created were the GATT standard, mm-hmm. Game Authentication Terminal standard, which is definitely one of the most widely used. Now there's also a network version that was made out of that, so you can do this over network remotely, which basically regulators don't have to leave their office. They can just remotely log in and check the software and machines. Wow. There's also systems, correct. There's also a regulatory reporting interface, which provides all the information that a regulator ever would want to get his hands on. The subset is the one Mark talked about, which was done for online, the OGR, right? Online Gaming Reporting Standard, which became a CEN standard, which is the European standardization body, the 2017. So there's a whole slew of things we have done. With all the volunteers, and I'm frankly honest, Jess, we should recognize the people who've actually supported this organization so far. And I can tell you some numbers. Over the 25 years, more than 1,800 engineers.
Wow.
1,800 engineers from more than 195 companies contributed to the expertise to the technology that GSA has developed. So that's about companies that supply 70% of the global marketplace. Think about that. So it's quite significant.
And these are highly valued engineers that these companies would volunteer to work with their competitors to create these standards. So they too saw the value in creating these standards. Maybe we'll talk about this.
We will. But he did talk one of the rewarding things, right, that I can say looking back, one of the most rewarding things is what we just touched on. The fact that these competing engineers or companies come together in such a truly amicable way under our guidelines and policies, obviously, that we had to put in place. And they really are discussing the best of the best. These are engineers of very high caliber, and they forget their companies. They really want to do what's best for the industry. And that resulted into solid standards that we created with them and with our previous standards director, which should not go unnoticed, Ethan Tower, who, frankly honest, not only his background was perfectly suited as well, but from operational engineering perspective, but Ethan was the passion behind rallying these engineers, these talented engineers, together and make this happen. And for me, looking back, it's amazing to sit into meetings where you know that the business interests don't properly align, and a guy whispering in my ear over my dead body is never going to happen. The PUI is an example, a player user interface, and guess what?
It did happen.
It did happen. Yeah. It's amazing how collectively, collaboratively, in this unique environment of IGSA, people are willing to sit down and work on problems that the industry identified. And the organization's purpose and passion, Mark, myself, and Michelle, the team that we have, our passion is really trying to help the industry. And the industry has to make use of the organization, which they have definitely done in the past.
Well, and springboarding off of that collaboration, obviously one of the things that makes IGSA so great is the international part. So in addition to North America, you guys obviously have roots in Europe, Macau, and Japan. Could you talk a little bit about the international expansion and kind of how that came about and how?
Absolutely. It was 2007. I mean, first of all, what we've experienced over these initial decades or two decades or one decade is that we understood that legacy plays a major role. Legacy deployment plays a major role in stopping or not enabling the adoption of open standards, right? And the reason is very simple. These CMSs are pretty expensive, these management systems. If you want to go to open standards, you have to change a big part of or do a gradual transition towards the open standards. And that's a very expensive undertaking. So when in 2007, we landed up in Macau, Cotai didn't even exist. Cotai, by the way, is what everybody refers to as here, the Las Vegas Strip. Mm-hmm. It's a connection of two land masses, which is one is called Coloan, and the other one is called Taipa. So Taipa, Cotai, Coloan, Taipa. That the combination of these two names of these islands in Macau is another island, that created the strip. So it's a landfill. We were standing in a tower. There was a big tower in Macau where the initial gaming shows took place. We're looking outside the window, and I said, this is going to be the Las Vegas Strip, or the Cotai Strip, as it's known today. Mm-hmm. It's incredible what happened. Now, I mentioned that because where did the idea for Macau came all about? When we saw that we were there and this is a new brand, a new market, we said, fantastic. There is no legacy. People don't suffer from the legacy implementations. We've been there since the 80s using antiquated serial technologies, almost using a fax machine today. I mean, that would be the analogy. So what we did is identified colleges where you can educate young engineers in the technology colleges so that they have an understanding about not only the legacy system, but also about the standards. We thought that would be a great idea to get these guys informed, educated, which we did. We've identified the Macau Polytech University, as it's known today. It used to be called Macau Polytech Institute, but became a university by Beijing. And we had a fantastic, or have a fantastic partnership with that institute. And we created over a year a curriculum together with the professors. They flew to Vegas, we flew to Macau. We attracted and identified the most talented people in the gaming business, and we flew them over there, or vice versa. The Macau professors came to Las Vegas, and we worked together by educating them about gaming. And now the whole idea was, okay, once these people put their program in place and these young engineers graduate through the four-year course, they would hopefully then identify the opportunities or see the opportunities for building systems and new and expand and come up with new products and new innovations. That was the impetus of that. I think we've done very well in the educational program with Macau Polytech, but of course Macau went through his ups and downs. But what we didn't realize, and it's the same with Europe in a certain way, but Europe is a different twist, is that once these markets open up, well, guess what? These American companies or Australian companies, they just popped whatever they have working here in the US, they pop it down in Macau, switch the switch on, and in a couple of months you're up and running, right? So if you think about time to market and time to make money, that's what happened. That's obviously was not part of the initial thought process, but the reality turned out to be, even today, new markets, Vietnam or other places that open up, or soon Thailand, you got these large companies who already have these operators, they have these systems in place, they simply take it, copy it, drop it down and switch on. That's the way it works. So it's very hard then to go in there and make sure that these technologies are transferred. And if they are being transferred or upgraded, it's a long process. Now, in Europe, why did we go to Europe? Online gaming clearly was something that was on our radar screen in 2015 or 16. We did a study done by the then ex-chairman of the MGA, Maltese Gaming Authority. He did a study for us. He spoke to us in Vegas as well. We created a big publication, and we decided Europe would be a fantastic place to go because there are a lot of online companies. And why don't we go to these companies, identify the challenges so that when these companies come to the US, we in the US don't have to struggle with all these legacy problems, because we're going to create standards to address that. And that is why we set up in Malta. Malta is the main hub for online gaming. There's a lot of knowledge out there, and that's what we had to do. We also had companies that prefer to pay or be a member in Europe under the European legal system, and therefore we had to adjust our bylaws and policies to facilitate that. That was not an easy one to do, but we did it. It took many months to set up a legal structure, and that's done. And afterwards, we also copied that to Japan, and now we are exploring new opportunities in the short term. Mark, you want to add to Europe or anything?
Yeah, I think you said it very, very well, Peter. Online gaming was and continues to be explosive in Europe. If you think about what's happening with sports betting in the U.S., and where the majority of the sports betting companies are coming from, it is from Europe. They're European companies. And so we believed firmly that there were opportunities for standardization, and we wanted to explore them. And the only way to do it effectively is to have an office there to prove that you've got European roots, to make sure that you can work with the European companies on their terms. And we were able to do that. In fact, we developed another plumbing standard, another communication protocol that really can eliminate all of the proprietary ones that are out there. We call it the third-party interface, third-party game interface. it really is a communication protocol that works between remote gaming systems and aggregators, between aggregators and internet gaming platforms, between remote gaming servers and internet gaming platforms directly. And again, instead of having to implement multiple different proprietary versions, you implement this API once. And as long as the other party has also implemented it, the integration is quick, it's easy, and it's pretty cost effective. The challenge, of course, as Peter said, is you've got companies that are looking to drop their existing system and start operating as quickly as possible. So having conversations about, how about you delay so you can implement this new standard, which will pay you dividends in the long term, but which will, you know, cause you to not make some money in the short term. Those conversations are very difficult, to say the least.
Well, I'm sure that if recent history is any indication, that the expansion of gaming is going to continue, and I am sure that in the future that IGSA will continue to expand as well. Speaking of the future, and I'll get you out of here on this, by the way, guys, I really appreciate your time again. As the organization obviously looks forward to its next 25 years to continue the theme, what are you guys most looking forward to, and kind of, you know, what are your biggest hopes as the sort of next generation kind of takes the reins?
Oh, global adoption of open standards. Hey, it's like world peace.
Yeah, I was going to say, there it is. Simple.
The global adoption of open standards. Wow.
In the gaming industry. Well, that's going to be a challenge. But
Maybe in that case, it'll be GGSA. It'll be Global Gaming Standards Association.
There you go.
Now you're talking.
I think, honestly, just what I think is going to happen is what everybody ultimately believes is going to happen. I wish we all had the crystal ball that we could, you know, tell you when it's going to happen. But just like, you know, standards exist for tires, car tires, just like standards exist for, you know, electricity and light bulbs and a bazillion other, you know, areas of life. We also believe that at some point in time, companies will start to realize that it just doesn't make any sense to continue to spend money developing these proprietary APIs, for example, these proprietary communication tools, when quite frankly, the days of being able to compete on that low-level technology are long gone. I think what's also going to happen is as newer generation of operators take the helm, operators that are now used to infinite amounts of data, they're going to start looking at gaming devices and saying, wait, I know these gaming devices have high-powered computers in them. I know that they've got tons of data. Why is it that I can only get this little trickle as opposed to all of it? They're going to realize that, it's because they're using a protocol that was developed in 1985 before any of them were born, right? So they're going to start to realize that, hey, we need a fresh approach. Are there any standards that can be applied to get full access to data? I mean, everything we hear about today is AI this, AI that. Great. AI, you know, whether you hate it or you love it, whether it's going to kill humanity or help humanity, you know, AI needs one thing:
fuel,
data. And it needs accurate, you know, clean data. And if you think you're going to have a casino management system, as Peter said, that is AI enabled and is going to survive on the trickle of data it's getting from gaming systems today, it's not an AI system. You're fooling yourself. So I think what we expect is that over time, the idea of standardization, especially at this low level, will continue to become more and more necessary and will be implemented. And maybe at one day, we will get to global open standards.
Yeah, but besides the technology element, it's the regulatory element, which I think both Mark and myself are excited about. I mean, the regulators, the relationship you have with the International Gaming Regulators Association, the IGAR, is a very important one. We need to be able to have open dialogues to enable innovation for our industry to grow and to work together on what is reasonable and what is not reasonable, right? And today there seems to be this kind of protective attitude, concerned about making a mistake, double-checking everything. There's always going to be mistakes being found, but we have to, I think, more open, more practical, and having conversations. And the fortunate position of GSA is we've always been and always continue to be, as long as I'm involved, an apolitical organization. Apolitical. And as a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons why at the time in South Africa, we walked literally away from the table when I was told they want to become a political organization. I'm talking about Gamma South Africa going back in 1990, whatever. And I said, no, the organization cannot be a political. You cannot create standards in fairness and then start lobbying. That doesn't make sense. So that's the first thing. And we are truly being recognized more and more so. And the fact that we now have a relationship with Agger is, I think, a testament to the fact that they realize that what we do is trying to be, or we are Switzerland, and we only have one goal in mind, is have a truthful, open, honest conversation, right, with a lot of integrity that this industry requires, together making progress. And I think for me, that would be the best step for the industry forward, is a closer regulatory, right, relationship building, regulations that are not fragmented all over the world, but there's no need for that. It should be hopefully almost, I would say, a federal for the US, but a national or maybe international set of regulations that are practical, are enforceable, can be monitored with open access to data and full transparency. And for me, that would be the next phase versus technology. Technology will come. It moves already so fast, right, Mark?
Yep.
Wow. Well, again, thank you guys so much for joining me. Peter, Mark, it was so great to have you on. And truly, it was humbling to hear the history of everything that you guys have done to serve the industry that we now enjoy the fruits of. I look forward to seeing the next 25 years of IGSA. Of course, we will be talking to Earl and Namish as well in episode 2 to hear more about that. But again, thank you guys so much for all that you've done, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this week's episode, sponsored by Pavilion Payments. To learn more about Pavilion's full suite of gaming payment solutions, visit pavilionpayments.com. To learn more about Jeff and his journey with Slot Cycle, visit ggbmagazine.com. Subscribe to GGB News to get all the news of the gaming industry delivered right to your desktop every Monday morning, and be sure to use the coupon code GGB180 for a free subscription. Don't miss an episode of the GGB Podcast by subscribing on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify today. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.